Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Charlotte Line. This is Dr. John from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, the home of sun, fun, and coronavirus.
Well,
I was hoping somebody would laugh. It's the truth. But anyway, so we're all down here and just trying to stay inside and stay cool. We did have some rain today, but it's just great to be back here on the Charlotte Line with everybody. And from Studio G, it is Zach. How are you doing tonight, Zach?
I am great, ready to talk racing because we have a lot to go over.
Well, we do. And from Studio D, from Des Moines, it is Brady Van Sickle. How are you doing tonight, Brady?
Oh, can't complain. It's been a pretty decent couple weeks here in Iowa, so ready to talk some racing. Like Zach said, we have plenty to get to.
All right. Well, now somebody better start talking about racing then right now.
Well, we can definitely say it wasn't a lackluster of racing this weekend. It was an historical racing. It was the first time NASCAR has actually scheduled a doubleheader back-to-back racing at Pocono for the Cup Series, doing dual races, and not like a 50% race, 50% race. They did well over 650 miles. I believe it was 675 at the grand total. And the wear and tear on some of those cars were just astronomical. Some of it was fine, and others, well, you couldn't tell they were using the car that you did yesterday where they finished the day on Sunday.
Oh, yeah, no, it was definitely the oddest thing I think I've ever seen in racing. I was not prepared for four races in the span of basically a 24-hour period almost. That was wild. But as a racing fan, I loved it. It was what we always dream of, just a constant all-day stream of all-day NASCAR.
I can tell you, I loved it. I helped my buddy with his business doing streaming stuff on Sunday, and I had my computer popped up with the racing and watch and helping him do his stuff and watch the race at the same time. It was just like a live. It didn't go according as planned, though, for NASCAR. Saturday, they were supposed to have the trucks and the cup race, but the trucks got rained out and then moved that to something that I don't think a lot of people thought we would see in our lifetime. Is all three NASCAR sanctioned bodies, the NASCAR Gander Mountain Outdoors Truck Series, the Xfinity Series, and the Cup Series all running in one day at the same track. It was truly something that before we went live, I didn't think I'd ever get to see this in my lifetime, and it was really cool.
And the interesting thing about it is having them all run same day, same weather conditions, same track, one right after the other, it really just showed you the difference in how the three different series is, how their individual vehicles operate on any given weekend. Never before have we gotten such an intimate, you know, exact lineup of the difference in racing styles between the Truck Series, Xfinity Series, and Cup Series, especially with their different aero packages that they all campaign. So that part was also interesting to me, to see exactly the difference between how the three different series is race. And honestly, I don't know about you, but after a day of watching all three back-to-back-to-back, I think it just reiterated for me that the truck races are some of the most entertaining that NASCAR has to offer.
And you know me, I love the Truck Series. I love any form of racing, but the Truck Series always has a pull in my heart. I feel like a lot of people have that. But one big thing was that there's a consistency with the Truck Series and the Xfinity Series. They could not go through the first stage without having three cautions and even a red flag, which was just wow. I mean, and we'll get to those in a few moments, but just how crazy the start of both of those races on the same day, within 3 hours of them starting each other, just it was crazy to see how similar they were in the first 45 minutes of each race.
It really was. And I guess before we start teasing some of that, let's take a look here. Then Saturday, the one race that we ended up getting to run in before the lights kind of went out at the Pocono Raceway, even though the truck race was rained out that morning, the skies cleared and we were able to run the entirety of the Pocono Organics 325 Saturday afternoon for the Cup Series. And I was honestly surprised. The clouds were kind of threatening all afternoon long. I really thought we might have gotten a rain, you know, delay in there, maybe cut the race short. And I figured, you know, with all that, you know, looming in the distance, we'd see a lot more, you know, side-by-side action, a lot more daring moves for the lead. But it was a pretty tame race by all accounts. And it came down to fuel strategy, which is honestly what I thought was really entertaining from all the races at Pocono, which is how pivotal and how important fuel strategy became in all four races, and just how drivers kind of had some different options, especially in the two cup races, with there being a lot more green flag runs to really take the cautions where they flew and then try and really get a strategy that would get them to the win, which is ultimately what happened for our winner, Kevin Harvick, coming down to in the final stages. Eric Almirola, who had dominated most of the day, leading 61 of the race's 130 laps, so dang near almost half of it. He was out front, cruising away, won stage two, looked like he was in position for his first non-super speedway win at Daytona or Talladega. And then Harvick and Denny Hamlin both leapfrogged him on that final pit stop by utilizing the strategy to their advantage and utilizing the tire strategy a little bit too, because it didn't seem like the Goodyear tires were falling off that much on Saturday or Sunday. So by utilizing the strategy to his advantage, Kevin Harvick, the closer, was able to leapfrog both his competitors and hold off a hard-charging Denny Hamlin for his, unbelievably to me, his first win at Pocono.
Yeah, and that was something that NASCAR or the broadcast did even mention themselves quite a bit, because Harvick's record there was like 30-plus races without a win. And, you know, Kevin Harvick has won at every track minus Kentucky, and there's one other I cannot think of at the top of my head. He has not won. He is one of a few active drivers that has won at just about every single track on the NASCAR circuit for the Cup Series. And you're right, that hard charge towards the end, he was a contender. He was up there for quite a bit. He started in the ninth position, and he just took that number four car. He just kept it up front and kept it in that clean air and was really able to use great pit strategy and just all-out speed and determination. You know, Harvick you can't deny he's one hell of a wheelman, and both teams he's ever raced for, RCR and Stewart Haas Racing, he's always been a contender. He's obviously shown that by winning the championship, but now getting over 50-plus wins altogether and getting more wins at Stewart Haas than he did at RCR. But you can't forget Denny Hamlin finishing second, and he did win Sunday's race, and we will go into more detail about that. But Denny Hamlin himself, that is a track that he excels in, got his first career win ever at the Pocono, was his first, you know, was incredible, and that's something you don't see, a driver getting the first ever victory there. But he was someone that was contending up there. He had five wins there, he now has six, but still leading 10 laps, getting second behind Kevin Harvick. I don't think Denny was disappointed. He was wishing the race was a little longer, because the race itself was only 130 laps, but I think he was very pleased with himself and his crew with how well he had performed that day.
And, you know, kind of going off of Harvick being a little bit shocking that it took him so long to get his first win at Pocono, I think if I remember hearing correctly, he had 5 second-place finishes to his credit at the Tricky Triangle before getting that maiden win, which was kind of funny because Denny Hamlin, his competitor that really gave him a run for his money on that last run there, had 5 wins going into that race. So a little bit of kind of a differing scenario with the bridesmaid, never the bride kind of situation there. But also, it really was entertaining to see Denny Hamlin, who clearly had the better car in those final few laps, charging as hard as he could, trying to get the lap cars caught at the right area and trying to put the pressure on Kevin Harvick, and just seeing the veteran presence of Harvick, just seeing him look at Hamlin closing his rear view, not missing any of his marks, not making any mistakes, getting around the lap cars at the right area. Just the true mark of the veteran driver that Harvick has become. And it showed, because he was finally able to put it all together and take that win.
For sure. And Harvick is, you know, he again, one hell of a wheel man. But just seeing, you know, Stewart Haas won first and third. And like you said, Eric Almirola, we can't talk him down. He led the most laps for the race, leading 61 laps. He also got the most points out of the day, getting 53 points, leaving the start-finish line that day, got the most points, led the most laps, and was in line to get his very first win outside of a super speedway, where people say it's purely luck, and it is partly luck. Almirola has been impressive since we've started this season. He's been impressive, a little more impressive since he's gone to Stuart Haas Racing. And I think this is maybe a turning point for him. He's like, you know what? I know what I have. I know what kind of equipment we've been racing with. And I definitely know what we need to do.
Well, and they've paired him up with crew chief Mike Bugaravich, that was the crew chief on the number 14 for several years, including the last couple years of Tony Stewart's career. And while he's never really found the success that some of the other crew chiefs have over there at Stuart Haas, I really feel like that's a strong pairing. In 2018, when Eric Almirola first joined that number 10 operation, it was a complete 180 for that entire team after several seasons with Danica Patrick. And I really thought, you know, we were seeing the beginning signs of a true, you know, dynamic pairing there with Almirola and that Stuart Haas team, because he was just picking up top 10s, top 5s left and right, and got that win there at Talladega in 2018. But then last year they introduced the Mustang, and the Ford camp kind of fell a little bit down on speed compared to 2018, but Almirola just kind of fell off the map. I mean, he qualified for the 16-driver playoff for the second consecutive year, but he did not have near the success in his 2019 campaign as he did in 2018. But this year, it kind of feels more like 2018 again. He's kind of found that consistency a little bit more. The number 10 organization showing a lot more speed than they did last year. I think the Mustang, with its second year in cup competition, has finally worked out some of those minor kinks that were keeping it from the dominance of that old Fusion body they campaigned in 2018. And I really like that pairing of Bugaravich and Almirola. And I really think that might pay off dividends as we get closer and closer, you know, towards chase time. And as those two just kind of figure out the dynamics of how they like to communicate with one another, and Bugaravich finds out more about what Almirola is looking for as far as handling is concerned and feeling the car. And if they're showing this much strength, you know, this early in the season, you know, this is kind of the tipping point where we really see the drivers that have got it figured out or the drivers that are still struggling. And I really feel good about that pairing as we get further and further on into the season and closer to playoff time.
Oh, that is for sure. I mean, Almirola has been someone who he's been in equipment. He's been in Stuart Haas equipment, but Junior Motorsports equipment, Richard Petty Motorsports equipment, Joe Gibbs equipment. He's been in the spectrum of a lot of stuff, but he didn't get his real big break in racing full-time until he did racing for the King Richard Petty Motorsports, and then never had real success, moves over to Stuart Haas, brings over Smithfields, you know, and like I said, 2018, yeah, he had a fantastic season. 2019, I feel the Ford camp in general hurt it, and you kind of said that yourself because they were still adjusting to this new body style. But now Ford is back, Almirola is back, and just fighting hard. But another thing for this top five, if you look at it, is a young man who former Xfinity champion, former driver for Kyle Busch himself, Christopher Bell, getting his first top five of the year and one of the better finishes for Levine Family Racing.
Well, and it was a great race for Bell, who's actually a former Truck Series champion. He didn't actually get the title in the Xfinity Series, unfortunately. Got bested by my boy Tyler Reddick a couple years running there. But, Bell had a great run. He didn't have as much luck and, you know, success on Sunday, but his Saturday race was one of the most perfect executions by a rookie we've seen this year. And it just seemingly is popping up week in and week out that one of the rookie drivers just puts together the most veteran-like performance and gets a really good finish. We saw it with Tyler Reddick at Homestead, and then, like you said, Saturday with Christopher Bell getting his first-ever career top five in the Cup Series, a very strong fourth-place finish. And for that team, Levine Family Racing, even though they technically, in most eyes, are considered a satellite Joe Gibbs Racing team, they pride themselves on the individuality of that team and the fact that they work as individually as they can to prepare the cars the way that they want them to. Because it's not the same situation that Furniture Row Racing had with Joe Gibbs Racing back in the early, back around 2017, 2016, where literally they were preparing Joe Gibbs Racing cars in Colorado. And sharing, you know, data as far as setup and telemetry as much as you can between two separate teams. But Levine, they buy their chassis, they buy their equipment from Joe Gibbs, but that's kind of about the extent of their deal. They really pride themselves on the fact that they do it their way. They're earning their way through the sport. and I was I don't remember what race it was, but I was watching a old race during one of my phone shifts just to have it on the background. And it was a race right around 2013. I think it was the Talladega Aaron 499. And I'm just watching the cars go by, and you know, there's this red and silver and blue, just gaudy looking, ugly number 95 car. And it caught my attention because I think it was Scott Speed who was driving at the time, back when the team was first formed. And, you know, just I caught myself, you know, getting a little nostalgic. Like, man, we have really seen this organization really grow by leaps and bounds in such a short amount of time, because they've really only been a part of the sport for, I don't even think it's been a full decade yet, because I think they came in right around 2010 or 11. And just seeing the amount of growth that they've had, you know, getting Casey Kane behind the wheel in 2018 probably added a lot of veteran experience that team had never had the access to. And then just how much Matt DiBenedetto was able to grow that program and really build his guys up around him and turn that organization into a legitimate contender, you know, maybe down the road. And so them getting probably arguably one of the hottest prospects in NASCAR right now, and the, one of the most sought out talents right now in the sport with Christopher Bell, can only be further helping that program. Unfortunately, they've not had, you know, a lot of the finishes or the speed that they've been looking for so far in 2020, and it looks like the Toyota camp as a whole might be struggling just a bit, but even so, you can still see the growth in that team. There's still so much untapped potential with Levine Family Racing, and just seeing them finally put together a full race, get that first top five, you know, under their belt, it was just really great to see, not just for Christopher, but for that entire organization.
Oh, for sure. I mean, as someone that's been a fan of Levine Family Racing because of the whole, you know, Michael McDowell, he's my driver. He was with them for many years and got them some real great momentum pushes, including one of their first ever top tens at a non-super speedway at Homestead when he ran the 59. It definitely is something that is a great feel for them and definitely feels like a victory for sure. And you're right, he is the best finishing Toyota of this for this race, but Toyota kind of performed a little better, or the second best Toyota, I should say, because Denny Hamlin, of course, got second, and then it was Christopher Bell in the fourth position, and Kyle Busch getting really one of his better finishes, if not best finish of the year so far. Kyle has not won a race yet. He finished fifth with the M&M Mini car. It was kind of strange to see. It's still weird right now, and I don't know if it's because of the pandemic or what it was, because he was pretty decent before we kind of went into this whole hibernation of NASCAR, but he just hadn't had the performance, and then he comes up with a top five finish at the first race of the weekend.
Oh, yeah, no, and it was definitely going to be the highlight of the weekend for that number 18, as he ran into some issues in Sunday's race. But it wasn't just those three in the top five. Martin Truex Jr., you know, he got his Toyota up there in sixth. So that's four fast Toyotas in the top six of the race. And that's something we have not seen for the majority of the 2020 season. Because we've talked about it at length that the Toyota camp is definitely down on competition from what we're used to seeing out of that camp, especially considering their run from about 2016 all the way through last year, where they were just winning races left and right. They really seemed like they were hitting on all cylinders. So definitely it was this mark of improvement for that camp, as they're just trying to find that missing speed that seems to be plaguing that whole organization. As it so far stands, that Denny Hamlin and Truex are the only two drivers from the Joe Gibbs Racing camp to pick up a win so far in 2020. Because surprisingly, I still can't wrap my head around Kyle Busch's struggles this year. I looked at a breakdown of his stats comparing the first 15 races of 2020 versus the first 15 races of 2019, and it's not just that he's not won, but he's down on top five, top tens, laps led by a significant margin. And so they always talk about when you win a championship, the hardest thing to do is back it up because of that championship hangover, and it's really showing right now with the M&M's camp right now.
For sure, it is strange to talk about Kyle Busch not in. Well, there's two lights we normally talk about him. He's either been really dominant, really winning and on top of it, or he's being a jerk or saying stuff he shouldn't be. And it's kind of weird to say that he's not performing as well. I mean, this was a great run for him. You know, didn't lead any laps, but still a top five finish. Started the race in fourth, still finished in the fifth position. I mean, not a fan, you know, not a bad day at all, but not a day that I think he'll be wanting to remember. I think the next day, Sunday, is a day he'll never want to remember, but that's for a whole different reason.
Oh, yeah, no, and honestly, I got to hand it to you, Zach. I've been kind of quiet on all podcasts, but there's a driver that got himself a solid top 10 there that I feel like you would have taken notice of.
I know, Clint Bowyer, man. No, Michael McDowell, that is something that I want to be modest about, because and you know this, and anyone that's like that's seen my collection of sheet metal or diecast knows I'm a big Michael McDowell fan, and this is a huge thing for him and that team, because they're not, Furniture Row is not a big budget team by any means. They only have two victories, one of them at Pocono, but not because of good strategy. Well, it was good strategy, but it was because of Mother Nature bringing in the fog, and Chris Buescher, who is now at Jack Roush Racing, got them their first and only win there. And then David Reagan, who is another guy I'm a big fan of, got the first real win, as what people like to call it, at Talladega, and that's just a great run for Michael. And you could just see his face when he talked about it on the post race interview for his Facebook page and for Front Row Motorsports Facebook page. You could just tell, you know what, he had more to give, and I think if he had two more laps, he'd probably be in the top five just because of how hard he truly was pushing that Deckside Logics 34 car. And I'm just like, oh. And he did lead a lap. He led a lap. So, you know, there's more bragging room right there for it, I think.
Exactly. And he definitely needed that bragging room, because just like everyone else, it seems like we've talked about, his Sunday race was a complete 180. And that's another thing that I feel like has really been mind-boggling as I've been looking down this top 10, is there were so many drivers that had such a good run on Saturday and then completely dismal afternoons on Sunday. It was truly the most whiplash weekend that I can truly remember, you know, where one moment you're on the top of the world and on the very next you are in the fence. So from that standpoint, that was also really odd. But, you know, and for Michael McDowell, what a good run for that driver. I mean, he's been kind of hit or miss this season. It feels like at times he's really, really got a good car, got a good direction. But or other times they're kind of slacking, bad luck gets in the way. And when you look at him compared to his teammate, John Hunter Nemechek, who's a rookie on this campaign, it seems like Nemechek's had a better season so far. It seems like we're constantly talking about him in the top 15, you know, really doing well and outperforming the equipment that he compared to his rookie rivals. And if you look at the point standings right now, that's kind of what it reflects, is John Hunter Nemechek does have the advantage over his older teammate there, Michael McDowell, where Nemechek is currently ranked 22nd in the points, and Michael McDowell currently ranked 23rd. But the difference between those two is only a scant 14 points, which is nothing in a given race weekend for the Cup Series. But it's still interesting to know, you know, when you compare those two, that Michael McDowell, even though he's got a lot more experience, it just seems like John Hunter Nemechek just has that a little bit extra over his veteran teammate so far in 2020. But that pendulum can swing back in McDowell's favor anytime. If he gets more runs like this, that's definitely going to help him as he's trying to get his 2020 season righted and get as much of those solid finishes in as he can possibly muster.
Oh, for sure. And just to run down the top, run down the finishing order, like I said, Kevin Harvick with a win, Denny Hamlin second, Eric Almirola in third, Christopher Bell in the fourth position, Kyle Busch in the fifth position, Martin Truex Jr. in sixth, Clint Bowyer in the seventh position, my guy Michael McDowell finishing eighth, Brad Keselowski having a great run for himself finishing ninth, Chris Buescher, who has won at that track and finished in 10th place, Matt Kenseth, and we should touch this real quick, getting his best run so far of 11th place in the 42 for Chip Ganassi, Ryan Blaney finishing 12th, Matt DiBenedetto having a great run in the Wood Brothers Ford for 13th, William Byron 14th, Ryan Newman in the 15th position, Cole Custer, another rookie, finishing 16th, Ricky Stenhouse Jr. finishing 17th, Kurt Busch finishing the 18th, Austin Dillon 19th, Ryan Preece finishing in the 20th position, and he would start on the pole for Sunday's race because they inverted the top 20, Jimmy Johnson finishing 21st, 22nd being Bubba Wallace in the Victory Junction Richard Petty Motorsports camp, Corey LaJoie having a great run in the 23rd position, and he is the – I take it back. Bubba Wallace is the first car to be a lap down following Corey LaJoie. John Hunter Nemechek finishing 24th. Chase Elliott not having the run he was expected to have, finishing 25th. Ty Dillon finishing 26th. Alex Bowman, another Hendrick car, not having the best run, finishing 27th. Daniel Suarez finishing 28th, two laps down. Brendan Poole, your guy, having a decent run, 29th place, and finishing three laps down. Tyler Reddick, who had a little bit of misfortune, finishing 30th, four laps down. J.J. Yaley finishing in the 31st spot. Josh Balicki finishing 32nd. Garrett Smithley, 33rd. James Davis, who made his appearance this weekend instead of at Talladega because NASCAR would not allow him to race, finishing 34th in his first ever Cup Series start. Timmy Hill finishing 35th. Joey Logano finishing 36th. Joey Gase finishing 37th. Eric Jones finishing 38th with a crash. BJ McLeod finishing 39th with a transmission issue. And Quinn Hoff finishing 40th with a crash. Brought out the caution on lap 19. He would not return to the track. And honestly, there wasn't a lot of cautions we should go over real quick. Competition caution lap 14, accident at lap 18, Quinn Hoff, stage one ended at lap 30, a debris caution on lap 69, and then an actual caution on lap 73 for an accident between Tyler Reddick and Eric Jones. And then the end of stage two would be the last caution we would have. So not a lot of cautions, but still quite a bit of passing and great racing action. 2,334 passes under green, 21.4 per green flag. Man, not a lot of cautions, but still some great racing action.
And, you know, that's what it's been kind of the mark so far in 2020 that's really surprised me. We've seen a lot of great Cup races so far with very minimal incidents, very, very minimal bench fenders and broken sheet metal, but a lot of good side-by-side action. I really feel like the more that NASCAR continues to massage on this multiple different aero package idea for the Cup Series, you know, and trying to tailor the car more to the track than trying to get, you know, a one-size-fits-all solution to all tracks, has really a lot of potential. It's really opening up the Cup Series to some of the best racing we've probably seen in a good half decade, maybe even a decade. And this race was another great prime example of it. You had fuel strategy, you had a tire that held up great, side-by-side action for most of the event, and very low carnage. It was the perfect ingredients for a pretty tame but also extremely entertaining race.
Well, on the flip side of that, the truck race the next day, the next morning at 9:30 a.m., a little different.
A little different might be underselling it.
Well, we had a full field, 40 trucks, I'm sorry. And, so the end of first stage was supposed to be lap 15. They pushed it to lap 17 to get the two laps in of competition because there was one, two, three different wrecks that happened, taking out a lot of top-tier race teams. You had Matt Crafton, who didn't even finish a lap technically, which was surprising. To say something like that, you had Ty Majeski have a horrific crash, not the first time he's had one this season, unfortunately. And you also had a KBM truck with another pretty decent truck, Austin Wayne Self in the 22 for Goat Texan, have a big wreck. Like I said earlier, the difference between the Cup races, the truck, and the Xfinity were cautions, and man, just the truck race alone, it was a 60 lap race, and we spent almost half of it under caution,
which is just mind boggling when you really think about it, because it just seemed like every time we were getting a good rhythm going, someone would lose grip, someone would get up into the PJ1 and just, you know, rear end it. And we've kind of seen that be the case with the truck series at Pocono. I don't know what it is about the track surface, but those trucks just look so wickedly loose every time they go to the Pocono Mountains. And honestly, it's one of the most entertaining races that the truck series puts on every year, which is saying something because the truck series really knows how to put on a show. But it was great because, you know, it was equal parts that we're having drivers trying to struggle for grip, racing side by side. On this race, we had an average of 34.5 green flag passes per lap, which is insane for just how short this race was, only 150 miles. And it came down, you know, to an overtime finish. The number 83 truck, who was this week driven by, I don't even look down my order here. I'm not even
Tim
sure.
Views.
Tim Vines, or whatever his name is. Anyway, that Timothy guy that likes to support Trump, he spun out on lap 56, setting up a green-white checkered finish, and what a finish it was. Three-wide racing, you know, they're barreling off into turn two at Pocono. It came down to Brandon Jones and Austin Hill. They restarted on the front row. As they sailed off to turn one, it looked like they were going to duke it out amongst themselves. Austin Hill had a fantastic truck all race long and was really solid, and many thought that he was going to sneak away with the win. Brandon Jones, of course, driving that venerable and almost untouchable KBM number 51. You couldn't really rule him out. And so we really thought it was going to boil down to those two drivers. But then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Sheldon Creed, who led the most laps, 31 on the day, split those two lead trucks right down the middle to make it a three-man fight as they were barreling off towards the white flag. In the end, Brandon Jones was able to hold off those two very stout Truck Series regulars to claim, which this was hard to believe for me. I swore he had done it before, but this was Brandon Jones' very first win in the NASCAR Gander Outdoors Truck Series, which boggles my mind as many years as I saw him compete in those trucks, racing for RCR, and RCR equipment, but and then racing for some Kyle Busch Motorsports equipment. So the fact that this was his first win, I mean, blew my mind. But what a great maiden voyage win for you in the Truck Series to hold off two of the series regulars best with Austin Hill and Sheldon Creed, duke it out three wide racing, you know, in those last two laps. That's got to make you feel good. And he's going to need those good vibes because it didn't last but an hour before the Xfinity race. But we'll get that here in just a moment.
The big thing with Brandon Jones, and I've said this before to you and to some other people, is he's been racing for so long in top-tier equipment and stuff for so long that it was like, okay, you kind of have to prove yourself. To me, he still hasn't proven that he is a NASCAR driver. He has now gotten he's gotten two wins now in the Xfinity Series, and he's actually raced them hard, so I can't say he can wheel somewhat, but it's taken him too long in my mind for someone that's had top-tier equipment. You're not like Corey LaJoie, who's building himself up, and, you know, Corey hasn't won a race, but he's competed so hard in the K&N series, even win a championship for himself, or I'm sorry, the ARCA East and West series. He deserves to be in that equipment over him. But it was a fantastic race, and he did prove himself to be a contender with the best way to put it, with these regulars who are kicking some ass. I mean, Austin Hill is someone who we thought for the longest time in the Tyler Young Motor camp when he was with them, that he wasn't really up to anything. Then he goes to the 16 truck that Brett Moffitt had just won the championship with, goes out, wins Daytona, wins a couple more races, and he's competing for, you know, he isn't quite competing for the championship, but man, if he was in that final four, he would have had his first championship. You had Sheldon Creed, who's someone that has done a lot more racing than a lot of people know. He hasn't just been doing NASCAR. He has run off-road trucks and Trans Am, so he's been multi-racing, I guess is the best way to put it. Then you have Todd Gilliland, who has one win, and even though he wasn't really up there towards the end, getting a fourth place finish in his father's truck, you know, front row, my brain stopped working there for a second, you know, but racing front row truck, getting that fourth place finish. I mean, man, it's weird to see all youngins, and I do have to say youngins up there in the top five, because the oldest person in that group in the top 10 is Stuart Friesen by a long shot.
And Stuart Friesen had a much, much better day in Pennsylvania than he did when the last time the series was here. Because just like Matt Crafton was on Sunday, Stuart Friesen was the unfortunate driver that found himself backwards in the fence last year's Pocono race on lap one. So I don't know what it is about that very first corner, but they don't call it the tricky triangle for nothing. So much, much better afternoon for Stuart Friesen this go-around as he finished a solid eighth-place run there. But, you know, one of the drivers that really kind of made me sad, you know, that his race did not go as well as it did was Christian Eckes. He had led 10 laps on the day, was racing hard with his teammate Brandon Jones. He's kind of struggled a little bit. There's a lot of expectations on Eckes, especially when you look at his ARCA campaign from the last couple years. And he's kind of struggled, you know, adapting to the trucks and how they run in comparison to the ARCA cars. And it looked like finally he figured it out, was going to put together a full race, and then a tire of all things. Let's go on the number 18. And not with many laps left either. It was on lap 50. It was still under 10 laps to go. The tire cuts down, and he's backwards in the fence and out of the race. It was just absolutely heartbreaking for the young man because you can tell the pressure's on. He's driving for Kyle Busch Motorsports, and we thought last year with Harrison Burton and Todd Gilliland just how much pressure is on you if you drive a Kyle Busch truck and you don't win in the truck series. So not at all what that young driver was looking for. He's trying to you know, assert himself as a future contender and as a future champion, and well, hopefully he'll be able to rebound here in a couple weeks, but I don't know, that particular incident really stung for me because I was really pulling for Christian to finally put together the full race.
Oh, for sure. I mean, even though Kyle Busch Motorsports did win, he had three trucks that were really strong and really dominant. Rafael Lazard finished 37th, and the big reason for him is he wrecked out along with Christian Eckes, but Eckes did lead 10 laps and was out at lap 48. But Raphael's incident, because I feel like we need to talk about this, because some people have kind of said that he wasn't paying attention or he was overthinking. If you watch the incident, he got a little too low because the traffic in front of him was kind of checking up a little bit, and there's not a lot of room for you to check low going into the corners. He got into the grass, and I mean, he got into it. The front end just picked up. He went straight into the wall, taking out Austin Wayne itself along with him, who was almost part of the first crash on the very first lap going into the very first corner. There's a lot of pressure for the KBM trucks, like you said, and you know that he was really thinking hard because of how tricky, you know, Pocono is. I'm just hoping we don't hear him say some bad words about his owner if he wins a race during the season.
Let's hope not, but no, and honestly, the Rafael Lazard incident was odd. The only thing I could even remotely think of that was similar to it was, do you remember back in 2014 when Dale Jr. accidentally went too low on the front stretch of Texas?
Yep.
Snagged that splitter in the grass. It reminded me so much of that incident. Just, it looked like he just, you know, was too focused on the incident that was going on in front of him, because it looked like a lot of trucks were checking up, and it looked like a potential accident was going to happen in front of him, and just got a little too low. So that splitter, once it makes contact with grass, it's kind of like if for all of our women NASCAR folks out there, if you're wearing a skirt and you're not paying attention, it's very easy to snag it. And if you're not paying attention, it'll take your ass down. That's kind of what the splitter is like. If you're not paying attention, it'll just snag on the closest thing to you, dig in, and just completely destroy your race truck or car. And unfortunately for him, that was a hard hit too, almost a dead head-on impact to the outside wall. And another case where it looked like he was in for a solid run. He's also kind of struggled getting his bearings in that number four truck this year, really trying to, you know, get the ship pointed in the right direction. But they'll load it back up and try it again. But, you know, I got to say, I kind of have to wonder where the quality of KBM trucks are at this current moment. It kind of strikes me as a Hendrick Motorsports kind of situation where we've gotten so accustomed, you know, through the 2010s, you know, when Kyle Busch Motorsports was established, of it just being the standard bearer, being the benchmark of excellence in the truck series, much like Hendrick Motorsports were through all those years. And these last two seasons, particularly, they just have not had that. Now, last year, it was easy to just point out at the two drivers, Harrison Burton and Todd Gilliland, as being the dead weight because Kyle Busch was still winning with the KBM equipment. But this year, even Kyle has struggled in his races in the truck series, which is very un-Kyle Busch-like. And you could tell on his face in his post-race interviews, there is something not quite right, not quite gelling over there at the KVM stables. And, it may just be me, but I'm not seeing anyone else really talk about it. So I feel like that's my role here in the NASCAR universe, is just to start posing those questions of what has happened to the Kyle Busch team. And is it just maybe a fluke deal where they're just missing it by that little much and suffering a little bit because of the lack of practice? Or is their equipment just off from their normal standard of excellence? I mean, time will definitely tell, especially if we get closer back to having normal race weekends where we can run test sessions, where the teams can actually shake down the cars properly and work on the setups. But it might be something to keep an eye on as the Truck Series continues to press on in the 2020 season, because I feel like a little bit of that magic might be missing from the KBM stable that we're accustomed to seeing.
I think one big thing to take away with the KBM trucks is whenever Kyle would race, he would win, unless he got wrecked out or had an incident on pit road. Last year, he won every single race that he was in. But I think one big thing for him that kind of might be hindering him right now is the lack of practice, because those teams, the last time he had ran a truck, they had to take a big swing on the first pit stop because it wasn't to their liking. So I think one thing is right now the practice might be killing them, because he still the KBM truck still had decent performance last year. There was some bad luck with pit stops and bad luck with wrecks, but decent performances. Not wins, but performance was decent. I do think you're right, though. This is something we're going to have to look at. And I think we would have to kind of give it a little more of a I guess the best way to put it is we need to give it a little more of a look when we get back to having practice. Because if we go to having practice and we see – because, a KBM truck won this weekend. It wasn't a championship contender truck by no means. It was a – it's a one-off truck that houses different drivers every week. But it's still a truck that is made by Kyle Busch Motorsports, chassis, body, dyno, everything done in-house. So I think it's something we all have to look at. But you're totally right, because that is something that I have been noticing a little bit is I don't want to say lack of performance. I want to say more or less lack of consistency. Now, this weekend, a little different because they both wrecked out because of wrecks not really under their own nature. One of them was a tire issue, which – happens, and Kyle was probably mad at Goodyear yet again, but that's nothing new. But I do feel we will have to keep an eye, a strong eye on the KBM camp, especially when we get back to a normal racing with practice and everything.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And let's kind of run down that finishing order here in the Truck Series. Like we said, Brandon Jones did hold on for his very first win in that series. Austin Hill came across the line in second. He was able to get back by Sheldon Creed, who settled for third. Todd Gilliland came across the line in fourth. A really great run by Ben Rhodes, quietly all afternoon. He came up with a top five finish there in fifth. Ross Chastain came across the line in sixth. Brett Moffitt in seventh. Stuart Friesen came home in eighth. Tyler Ankrum ninth. And Derek Krause rounded out your top 10. Grant Enfinger came across the line 11th. Tanner Gray in 12th. Johnny Sauter in 13th. Zane Smith 14th. Parker Kligerman rounded out the top 15. Bailey Curry, who was in the 44 this weekend for Natalie Decker, who was in the hospital for, I'm not entirely sure what it was, but I think it was some ongoing issues that she's been dealing with the last couple of years. But Natalie was not in the race.
Had to deal with gallbladder surgery she had back in December.
Thank you. I didn't quite get the full story on that, but definitely sending our well wishes to Miss Decker and hope to see her back behind the wheel of that 44 soon. But in her stead, Bailey Curry with a very impressive 16th place run. Behind Bailey Curry was Jordan Anderson in 17th. Spencer Davis came across the line 18th. Tyler Hill 19th. And Robbie Lyons in 20th. Chase Purdy making his inaugural start with GMS Racing in the Truck Series. Came home in 21st in the number 24. Spencer Boyd came across the line 22nd. Josh Rayum in 23rd. Corbin Forrester came home in 24th. 25th place was Corey Roper. Brian Duzet in 26th, Ray Cicerelli in 27th, Jesse Iwuji in 28th, Tim Veans in 29th, and Norm Benning in 30th. The rest of your 40th place runners include Clay Greenfield in 31st, Jennifer Jo Cobb in 32nd, Kristen Eckes after that wreck in 33rd, Tate Fogelman in 34th,
Brandon Poole, a dismal 35th after making contact with the outside wall. Ty Majeski, after his wreck, finished in 36th. Rafael Lassard, 37th. Austin Wayne Self, 38th. Cody Rohrbaugh in 39th. And Matt Crafton, after getting wrecked out on lap one, came home in 40th. And like we said, there were nine caution flags that flew throughout the afternoon, the first of which flew on lap two for the number nine of Cody Rohrbaugh and 88 of Matt Crafton making contact in turn one. We would get the green flag on lap six, but quickly be back under the yellow on lap seven when the number four, Rafael Lassard, made his contact with the inside grass and sent him straight up into the outside turn three wall in front of Austin Wayne Self. We were back under green flag conditions on lap 10. Ran a couple laps before the yellow flag flew on lap 13, this time for the number 98 of Grant Enfinger accidentally getting the back bumper of Ty Majeski on the front stretch, sending Majeski nose first into the inside wall. After that, we were able to end stage one on lap 17. We went back to racing on lap 20, but quickly the yellow flag flew once again on lap 24, this time for Brendan Poole making contact with the turn three wall. We went back to green flag racing on lap 27, and then a couple laps later, the yellow flag went back out, this time for number three, Jordan Anderson, going for a spin in turn one. Restarted there on lap 34, and then two laps later, we're starting to see a trend here. It seemed like every two laps, we were getting a caution flag. This one's flying on lap 36 for the number 02 of Tate Fogelman, and the number 15, this weekend driven by Tanner Gray. Gray actually got the back bumper of the 02 and sent him straight into the outside wall there in turn two, putting out the yellow flag. Restarted on lap 39 and then had a 10-lap green flag segment, which was the longest of the afternoon before the number 18 cut down a tire in turn two, putting him into the outside wall. And then, like I said, the last caution flag flew on lap 56 and the number 83 went for a spin off of turn one, setting up the final overtime restart. And what a restart it was. We had nine caution flags for 29 laps and the margin of victory was 0.864 seconds.
So one big thing I do want to say is that Ty Majeski had a great run going for him, was 19th, up to third, had his major wreck. But then another one, Parker Kligerman, who started dead last, he started 40th, finishing 15th. Some people say, that's not that good. At Pocono, when you're able to climb, 25 spots and finish with your car intact on the lead lap, that's a pretty damn good day. I do have to say so myself.
Well, especially for Parker Kligerman and that team he drives for. It's a very, very underfunded team. And Parker is a very underrated driver in my books. I don't think he ever got the proper due that he was, that he earned for his time in the Truck Series. And it's really good to see him get a solid finish like that.
For sure. So we leave a chaotic truck race, and just less than 45 minutes later, we got a chaotic Xfinity race. And boy, howdy, if you would have told me the truck race and the Xfinity race would have the same amount of cautions before the end of the first or before the first stage was over, I would tell you you're crazy. And then if you would have also told me that they would probably have the same amount of trucks or the same amount of vehicles out by that same point, I would say you're just as crazy again. But you would be right. Again, I said this a little earlier. We had a massive three wrecks before the four wrecks before the first stage was even over. And it just was it was baffling to see this many wrecks. And there was a lot more in this race than there were the Xfinity race, and a lot more cars taken out. Instead of just having, five or seven cars out, we have almost a third of the field been knocked out because of a wreck.
Oh, yeah, no. And you want to talk about whiplash. I don't know what hurt more for Brandon Jones, the contact of the inside wall on turn one or going from being a winner to finishing almost dead last in the span of an hour. I mean, actually, he did finish dead last. So the number 19, he got bumped in the rear by Austin Cindric as they exited off of turn one. And from going from to victory lane just an hour prior to head first into the inside wall, that is literally the epitome of the highs and lows of racing right there.
Oh, that is definitely for sure. And the winner of this race, Chase Briscoe, leading 24 laps. And then next to him, Ross Chastain, leading 31 laps. But who's in third? Spartanburg, which is only about 25 to 30 minutes away from me. Jeremy Clemens, in one of the and an underdog finish of a third, and then Matt Schneider, who's in the 21 this weekend, also getting a really great finish of fourth, and then Michael Annette getting a fifth-place finish. You see the first place, Chase Briscoe, okay, he's been winning constantly. Ross Chastain, okay, he's a great driver. He's won for that team. But then the next three, you're just like, where did these guys come from, especially Jeremy Clements?
Dude, you want to talk about a statement-making afternoon for Jeremy Clements to come away with a third-place finish against the absolutely stacked field that is the Xfinity Series competition. I mean, we really can't overstate just how amazing and how impressive that run was. And cause unlike a lot of the smaller teams that, you know, sometimes get some support, some satellite support from the Cup Series organizations, or they buy parts and pieces from Cup teams, the Jeremy Clements operation is completely family run. They build their own engines. They work on their own cars. And just the amount of success that they're able to find with such humble and meager means, it just continues to blow my mind. And Clements has been one of my favorite drivers in this series for a long time now. And I really love to see him and that team do well. Whenever I was out at the Iowa Speedway, I'd always make it a point to go over to their garage, say hi to him and the team, and try and get an interview with them just to get them a little more exposure and just to see the growth that I've seen since 2013 when I started following the organization to now. It's truly amazing, and it honestly reminds me of, you know, a feel-good story from the older days of NASCAR when you would literally just load up the family, load it up into a rollback trailer, get to the track, and compete with what you have. And that's what I see with Jeremy Clements in that 51 organization. And seeing him get a solid third-place finish, it was great.
That is, I mean, itself, I've talked about Jeremy multiple times. I was up at Road America when he got his win. The chassis he was running was 8 years old. The strategy they were on just worked out for him. And underdog is a great term for him because, you know, he does have some money backing him. He doesn't have as much as a lot of those guys. And I know some people say he's underfunded. He's funded. He could have more money to get better engines. That's the way I'll say it, and to get newer chassis. But instead, they use what they got, and they get great finishes, including a win, but also top five and top tens on a decent basis, especially this. I mean, yes, we did have quite a few cars wreck out, like Daniel Hemric in the eighth, Austin Cindric, Harrison Burton, Brandon Brown, you know, and some grade A equipment, but still a third-place finish for that team. And then you had Matt Schneider, who is someone who is running full-time in the Xfinity Series, but he's hopping ride to ride. He's hopping from Ryan Teague Racing 93, which they are now only going to be running two cars, one of them being the 39 for Ryan and the 93, and the Rehome Brothers Racing will be managing that car. He hops between that car and the 21, and this weekend he's in the top 21, and he gets a fourth-place finish. I mean, for Matt himself, that's a really great run for him.
And it didn't come without controversy. It was not quite the malicious drive by Myatt as it was, you know, looking back at the incident at Las Vegas where Noah Gragson punted the young driver, the 21, out of the way. But in kind of a similar fashion on lap 54, right just a little past the halfway mark there, Myatt got in the back bumper of the number 9 of Noah Gragson there on the backstretch and really didn't let off him. Ended up hooking the number 9 and turning him into oncoming traffic, triggering a 6-car incident. It was Pocono Raceway's version of the big one, and sadly, it swept up 3 of the 4 junior motorsports cars. It snagged both Allgaier and Hemric, and also took out one of the race's most dominant drivers, Austin Cindric, who that man, Cindric cannot catch a break this season. It seems like every time he has a dominant vehicle, it's either a pit road speeding penalty or, like in this case, an accident that just keeps him short of victory, but and also wrapped up in that was the number 39 of Ryan C, who's also just seemingly can't catch a break. And surprisingly, you know, even though a lot of those drivers seemed like they were going to be unable to continue, both Sieg and Allgaier, they patched those vehicles up and were still able to get some speed out of them despite all that damage. And that to me was really impressive. But, you know, one might say, the way Myatt got in the back of Noah and the way he hooked him, it looked like retaliation. And then who knows, it probably was. It's very hard to argue that it wasn't just a typical racing incident, just one of them deals. But who knows? I feel like those two have gotten into some contact now, and we might see that that might be the end of it. Maybe Myatt put his foot down, got his revenge, and now it's all hunky-dory, or who knows? This might be a budding rivalry where we might see them make contact even more in future races. But definitely it was a costly mistake, if that's what it was, that took out a lot of great drivers. We're having some phenomenal runs. I mean, Daniel Hemric really looked like he was in good position in that 8 car. Noah Gregson was showing speed just like he has all season. And I don't know, just one of them deals.
Just one of them racing deals, if I say. And you're right, that is something that NASCAR is taking a little bit of a look into. Today they would have released any penalties associated with that. Nothing has been said. We might hear something tomorrow. Just depends. But we also need to talk about an incident between another driver. And that would be Justin Haley and the 18 car. There's no easy way to say this, but if you looked at it, if you watched the race, or you saw anything, a highlight, you would see that the 18 just kind of got taken out by Justin Haley. There's no way of saying it, no way going around it. He was blatantly dumped going down the front stretch. I don't even see where the 18 is finished on here for some reason, but it was on lap 50 where the 18 just got dumped going down the front stretch just past start finish line. The 11 of Justin Haley just boots him, spins him out, and Justin Haley was held for 2 laps by NASCAR, and instead of finishing on the lead lap, because he only finished 2 laps down, he would have finished probably a lot better than the, let's see where he finished, than the 23rd. He probably would have been in the top 24th. So he probably would have finished a lot better had he not done that. And there might be some issues with him with NASCAR.
Well, and I didn't see anything that led up to that. I really didn't see any contact that was made in the laps leading up to that, or any way that Riley Herbst was out of line. But, yeah, no, it was as blatant can be. Because he came down and hooked Riley Herbst in the right rear and turned him towards the direction of the outside wall. And Herbst, you got to tip your cap to him. He was able to keep it out of the outside wall, did some harmless spins down the front stretch, and rallied to a 9th-place finish. So all things considered, I mean, that was a hell of a turnaround for Riley there, but – I don't know. I've kind of studied that incident now a couple times, and I'm puzzled, because it's very, very out of the character of Justin Haley to just dump someone like that without reason. And I don't know. I don't know if there's maybe an incident that occurred in a prior race or something that happened earlier in Sunday's race that I just didn't quite catch. But we'll have to keep an eye on it. You know, maybe it was just one of them deals, and now it's done and over with, and they can put it behind him. Or it might be a deal where Riley Herbst feels like maybe he owes one to the driver of the number 11 Chevrolet. But in the end, it ended up biting Haley more than it did Herbst, because, like I said, Justin was only able to recover to a 23rd place finish, and Riley Herbst bounced back to a solid top 10.
Yeah, that's for sure. That incident, I mean, the reason I bring it up is that brought a lot of attention to Justin Haley, because the week prior, he had just won at Talladega, going for the dash for cash, and instead of racing smart, racing clean, even if there was an incident, you have an opportunity to win $100,000. That's a lot of money for anybody. You have an opportunity for that, and you go and do this, and you blatantly lose out on that, and possibly lose that opportunity to sponsors. There has not been an interview or anything I've seen about what happened. Riley himself hasn't said anything. To me, looking at it, rewatching the first 10 laps before the incident happened, I can't tell anything that happened. Nothing was said on MRN or PRN, depending on who's broadcasting it. And I did not see anything on the race itself or hear anyone in the booth say anything. So it was a real puzzler, that is to say the least, on what in the heck Justin was thinking. But if you go through the top 10, there's still a couple more surprises we'll go through. I think we need to mention one of them being Brett Moffitt in the number 02 for R Motorsports, getting another fantastic run, and then Timmy Hill still on a hot streak in the 6-1, finishing 8th at Pocono.
And in addition to those two, Jesse Little for JD Motorsports getting a solid top 10. So, you know, while a lot of the big-name drivers, you know, found the outside wall, Harrison Burton, Brandon Jones, the three junior motorsports cars, it cleared the way for a lot of underdog teams to have their day in the Pocono Mountains. And a lot of those teams really need those runs. And, you know, talking about Brett Moffitt and that Power Motorsports group, the 02, they continue to just impress week in and week out. What they're able to do with this being a first-year team, I believe this is already their second top 10, maybe not even third, if not the third top 10 they've had so far in 2020, consistently running in the top 15 week in and week out, utilizing Brett and the wealth of experience that he can bring to that organization. I'm just continually floored every week by the progression that they show, by just how much they're improving each week, and how they've quickly grown this program that for the longest time was just an ARCA competitor into a budding Xfinity Series mainstay. And I continue to wish them well and hope that this continues to open the doors for more sponsorship opportunities for them to continue to grow that program, because it's truly, you know, wonderful to see new teams flourish, have a shot at the limelight, and to just see new faces coming in to fill out that garage area to kind of replace some of the aging out veteran team owners that we've come to know and love, you know?
Well, that's a big thing. Our Motorsports actually bought out a lot of GMS Racing's Xfinity program when they announced that they were not going to be running. They kind of sold a lot, if not a majority of that stuff. And they kind of picked Brett to run that Our Motorsports 02 because he knows a lot of those GMS guys. He knows a lot of the equipment and stuff. So they kind of asked him, slash Brett Box brought some money over. But altogether, you can't say anything bad about that because that team has been flourishing. And then I say we do need to say a big thing for Timmy Hill and that 61 team, because even though it is a Hirogo Toyota car number, it is not their equipment. In fact, it is an MBM Motorsports equipment. They are doing a team up with that with the other team, and for Timmy to get a top 10 finish at a non-super speedway track in that car, it's just incredible to see that. It was surprising. I had to recheck to make sure I didn't miss something, but seeing him get a top 10 at that track, I was like, wow, that's a big deal for that team.
Oh, it's a super huge deal. And it just continues to show, you know, the growth and the opportunities and the doors that were opened by how well Timmy ran, you know, in the eSports iRacing League during our quarantine. That exposure and that ability to showcase that he has true untapped driver potential, just has never had the equipment to show it, really opened him up to some different sponsorship opportunities. And since we've come back from the break, you know, he's not been flashy. He's not, you know, been setting the earth on fire. But for what he's been able to do with the equipment that he has been truly remarkable. And he just continues to set that bar week in and week out of just being able to really turn the curve of what's possible with the lower equipment he's running. And you mentioned that he's running a Toyota. When you look at his number 61, he's kind of different than the Toyotas that you see out the Joe Gibbs Racing camp, being that he's not running one of those sleek, fast Supras that have been on the campaign now for a couple seasons. He's running an outdated Camry body, probably from an old Joe Gibbs Racing entry that was sold for pretty cheap when they switched to the Super body. And just week in and week out, he continues to outperform with a whole lot less than a lot of his competitors around him. And you also mentioned that it's a really good partnership between his team that he's running and Shiggy Hattori, which campaigns the number 16 in the Truck Series. Shiggy has been trying to break into the Xfinity Series now for a couple seasons, been, you know, dipping his toe in the waters, made a couple starts last year with Austin Hill in that 61. And this year it's more of a partnership between himself and Timmy Hill, to where they'll run and field the cars for Austin Hill for a selected number of races this season, and then have Timmy Hill and the veteran experience that he can bring to fill out the rest of that schedule and to try and keep them high up in owner points. So that way, whenever they make their one-off start, they don't have to worry about qualifying.
That's for sure. So great racing action, again, chaotic as can be. 34% of laps completed were under caution. And it's not close to the 50%, but by golly, That's a third of the race was under caution, quite a bit. We can go through the top 20 or the go through the field real quick. Like I said, Chase Briscoe winning for the third time this season, correct?
Fourth time, actually.
Yes, you're right. Him and Denny Hamlin, the only drivers right now with four wins in either series. Ross Chastain finishes second, Jeremy Clemens in third, Matt Schneider in fourth, Michael Annette in fifth, Justin Allgaier in sixth, Brett Moffitt in seventh, Jimmy Hill in eighth, ninth, Riley Herbst, top 10, rounded out by Jesse Little for Johnny Davis Motorsports. Dexter Bean in the 11th, which that's a great run for Mario Gosselin Racing. Ryan Sieg in the top 12, rebounding from that wreck. Ryan Vargas making his first start for the year for Ryan or for Johnny Davis Motorsports in the 15, finishing 13th. BJ McLeod in 14th. Kyle Weatherman in the 47 car, which that's a good run for him, in the 15th position. Jeffrey Earnhardt in the 16th position. Alex LeBay in the 17th position. Vinny Miller in the 18th. Cody VanDewaal, finishing 19th. Carson Ware, he is the brother of Cody Ware in the Cup Series, finishing in the top 20th. Stephen Parsons finishing 21st. 22nd, Noah Gregson. Justin Haley in 23rd. Bailey Curry, who did double duty, finishing 24th. Not a bad run for himself. Matt Mills finishing 25th. I'm sorry. Chad Fincham, who had a very hard crash. He is luckily okay. He walked away after a few x-rays and stuff, finishing 26th. Stephen Lynch finishing 27th. Daniel Hamrick 28th. Austin Siegert 29th. Tommy Joe Martin finishing 30th. Jeff Green 31st. Harrison Burton finishing 32nd. Brandon Brown finishing 33rd. Josh Williams 34th. Joe Graff Jr. finishing 35th. 36th was Brandon Jones, who had just won the race previous. And I believe there's a dash for cash this weekend, right? Or am I going crazy?
Say one more time.
There was a dash for cash. Ross won the dash for cash, correct?
Correct. Ross did win the dash for cash. And honestly, more shocking than that was Alex LeBay, who was able to net a really strong run last week at Talladega to qualify in the fourth and final position for the dash for cash. Many people kind of wrote him off, but for a while there, with all the carnage going on and several of the dash for cash drivers running into incidents with number 11, Justin Haley, getting his two-lap penalty, finishing 23rd, and Austin Cinder finishing 29th, I started to wonder. I was like, well, you know, there's only a Ross Chastain standing in his way from being the complete most badass underdog in Xfinity Series history by walking out of there with a cool 100,000, but it wasn't quite meant to be. But still, the spotlight that was shown on that team, he drives the number 90 for Mario Gosselin, one of the most nicest, charismatic, funniest characters you'll see in the NASCAR garage. And it looked like it was meant to be there for a second, but fortunately that glass slipper was not quite big enough. But still, a very impressive afternoon. They got a lot of exposure for their sponsors. Hopefully a few more will come on to that program and really help them to continue to expand and improve. But still, all in all, he got into an accident actually pretty early on in the event where he went for a spin off of turn one. It looked like his day was going to be done because he made some contact that kind of crinkled up the front nose. But he was able to salvage that and still maintain a lead lap finish en route to a 17th place finish overall. So, you know, you got to love it with the underdogs. And I almost thought we were going to have the most ultimate upset there for that dash for cash there.
Oh, for sure. And talk about the dash for cash. It's essentially a $100,000 bonus for the top finishing car from the week previous. Qualifications being you're the top four cars from the previous race are entered. You have to be a point. You have to be running 4 points, or not points. You have to be running only the Xfinity Series 4 points to be qualified for it. And Justin Allgaier, or not Justin Allgaier, I'm sorry, AJ Allmendinger has won it, and Ross Chastain has won the other two so far, which, you know, walking away with $200,000 in 2 weeks' work, you know, I think it's a pretty good deal.
You know, and what a run in the dash for cash for Colleague Racing. They started off by winning the $100,000 with AJ Allmendinger, and then back to back weeks with Ross Chastain. I mean, that you gotta love the strength that whole entire organization has been showing this year. They've just been straight up flexing in the Xfinity Series, and another great run for the Watermelon Man. We'll be making a Cup Series start this week, and we'll have to talk about that if we have time. But No, overall, it was a really, really great afternoon for the Xfinity Series. One of the better races I think I've seen in that series all season long. They had a lot less green flag passes per lap than the other two races before them, but I don't know. It still felt like the race was high on action, despite the fact they only had that 14.5 green flag passes per lap average. But with that, that kind of puts the kebab there on the Xfinity Series and opens the door for our final recap of the evening, the 2020 Pocono 350, the second race in a doubleheader weekend for the Cup Series. And this was supposed to be how this was going to lay out, you know, pre-Corona, that this was going to be a doubleheader weekend, the first of its kind in the modern era of stock car racing for NASCAR's elite division. A lot of people, they've kind of panned the Pocono races in years as being boring. Definitely the case could be made that it was one of the most boring races on the circuit in the early 2000s. It went through a reconfiguration there right at the turn of the decade, right around 2010-11. And from there, I really thought the racing had picked up. They had given it some multi-group racing surface to work with. The early days of racing with the Gen 6 car put on some great racing. The COT, towards the end of its run, put on phenomenal racing at Pocono. But the last few years, it's kind of felt like being back in the early 2000s where the racing has not been that exciting. There really wasn't much to talk about. But then this weekend, you know, in an effort to try and, you know, maybe still keep racing in the Poconos, really keep the excitement there, they were going to pair them up, do both races in one weekend instead of going there once in June and then once in August to really try and kind of wrap that up nice and neatly, do it all in one weekend and still keep two races at the Pocono facility. With the coronavirus, that they kind of tweaked that a little bit and turned it into the four-race racing extravaganza that we were treated to this weekend, almost a buffet line of racing goodness there. And I don't know. I think it really worked. The shorter races, I felt like, definitely helped to condense the excitement level a little bit. Definitely the threat of weather and the skies darkening and maybe the threat of not being able to finish the entire race due to lack of lights in the track, I think kind of tipped its way into it. But, I mean, what a night and day difference between the first race and this race in the same weekend for the Cup Series. We saw a lot more wrecks, a lot more accidents. And it's kind of like with the Xfinity Series and the Truck Series, a lot of drivers are struggling for grip, which is what led into a lot of these on-track incidents where they just were running out of track, running out of racing room, and just running completely out of grip.
Oh, for sure. And looking at the caution, so 140 laps, we only ran 22.9% under caution. Not a lot, only about 30 laps or so under caution. But the green flag passes 2,294 for the race is really great. And then if you look at the top 10, and you said this earlier, it's kind of night and day. I mean, there's still, you know, Denny Hamlin, who got his sixth victory at Pocono, leading for 49 laps. Kevin Harvick, who finished second, leading 11 laps. Eric Jones, who had an abysmal first race. Chase Elliott, who had an race. And then Eric Almirola finishing fifth, leading four laps. But then you had Matthew Benedetto with a top 10, finishing sixth. William Byron finishing seventh. Clint Bowyer again in the top 10 with an eighth. Alex Bowman with a fantastic run of ninth. And then Martin Truex Jr., in fifth. And then you go down to the very bottom, you had three guys who had amazing runs, one of them being Michael McDowell, who had a very hard crash there on lap 15, and then you had Christopher Bell just 24 laps later. Then lap 74, you had Kyle Busch, who had a terrific crash heading into the safer barrier. It was just like, what? You look at it, it's just like, was that a dream or something? What happened? It's like, wow. It was truly great racing action, but also some hard, heavy hits for some people and points.
And, you know, the one thing that kind of stood out to me about not just this race, but also the two races that took place earlier that day, the Truck and Xfinity events, I saw a lot more drivers be punted into the inside wall than I think I've ever seen at a Pocono race, like to the point where I almost forgot that Pocono had an inside wall because it never really has come up in past events. But this weekend, I saw, you know, there was like two trucks that had head-on collisions. There was the two Joe Gibbs Racing Supras. They both got turned head-on into the inside wall. Kyle Busch got contacted, hit into the inside wall. Just something that I guess I I'm not used to seeing there at Pocono, you know, because normally it's very low on events, I mean, on incidents. And the incidents that do occur, they tend to, you know, gravitate up towards that outside wall. So that was also something that really kind of stood out to me and really kind of remarked on the aggressive nature of it. And I don't remember which driver it was, but there was one driver that went for a spin. He was going towards the inside wall, and Bubba Wallace had literally one of the amazing jobs of dodging a wrecked race car. Easy highlight reel material. And it was towards the latter stages of the race, so when the sun was kind of getting down, it almost looked like golden hour for all you videographer folks and photographer folks out there. Just picture-perfect look there, and Bubba just barrels it off to the inside of that spinning vehicle. I want to say it was, was it 17 that he was avoiding there? But
I think so.
Missed it by the skin of his teeth. And toward that inside of the track where he made his evasive maneuver, it wasn't quite level, wasn't quite a flat surface like it is on the racing surface. And through those dips, going as fast as he did, he almost Dukes of Hazzarded it right into the grass because he was up all four wheels off the ground there at one time. Just an incredible, incredible save by the driver of the Richard Petty 43.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that was definitely an incredible – he even said on the radio, I'm going to need some new underwear after that. And you can't blame him for that because, boy, howdy. So one thing we should mention about this race, so the teams used the exact same car as long as they needed to. A lot of drivers went to backups or had to change engines or transmissions. You look at the list of drivers that made these changes – there's quite a few of them. I'm counting at least 9 drivers. You had Quinn Hoff, who had to go to a backup car because of a wreck. Tyler Reddick, same thing, had a tire issue, which destroyed the rear end of the car. Chase Elliott swapped out a transmission. Eric Jones, who crashed out, went to a backup. Joey Logano, who had some contact with the wall, instead of trying to fix that car, be there in the wee hours, it said, we'll just unload the backup car. William Byron with an engine change. Ryan Preece with an engine change. BJ McLeod had to change a transmission. That's why the day actually ended early on Saturday. And Alex Bowman with a backup car. But you look at a lot of those guys, they still finished up there. Eric Jones, the highest finishing car out of all of them, finishing third. Then you had William Byron and Alex Bowman as well up there. So it's kind of cool to see a lot of these guys use the exact same cars that they're able to run, like Eric Almirola, who got his third place finish, got a fifth place finish. Denny Hamlin and Kevin Harvick ran the same engine, transmission, body, everything. They probably just had to beat it out just a tad bit, but it's incredible to see that they're able to go 675 miles on a car.
You know, and also what was really impressive about that, I mean, what are the odds that the Saturday race will come down between a duel between Denny Hamlin and Kevin Harvick, with Harvick getting the better of the number 11. And then the very next day, complete opposite. Harvick was the chaser, did not have enough car to track down Denny Hamlin, and Hamlin was able to get redemption literally 24 hours later. Like, you couldn't script that even better in Hollywood if you tried, for just the absolute parallels, the parity between those two events. And I still can't get over just how turned upside down the finishing order is, because, you know, both Byron and Bowman, like you mentioned, both those drivers were out to lunch, it seemed like, on Saturday, mired back in the 20s. Here they are, solidly in the top 10. The three worst-placed finishers in Sunday's race, Bush, Bell, and Kyle Busch, Christopher Bell, and Michael McDowell, they were all – two of those guys were in the top 5, and Michael Dowd had a top 10, and then they ended up completely finishing tail end Charlie. So it just really shows you the highs and lows of the sport right there in one weekend. One moment you're on top of the world, feeling invincible, and the next moment you're ass end into the backstretch wall, and you got to start completely back over. So I don't know. It's interesting, and I really enjoyed this doubleheader weekend. I don't know if it's something we'll see a lot going forward, but I really liked having two races at the same track in one week and to really just break down the data, really compare the notes for what the racing action we saw was. As far as competition level, it was very, very similar, 21.2 green flag passes per lap on average. So very similar there. A couple more lead changes on Sunday than what we saw on Saturday. And just, I don't know, it's really interesting to see two races back-to-back like that and have two completely different outcomes.
Well, especially like one big thing that happened too was they inverted the field, meaning the top 20 from 20th up front would swap positions. So 20th start first, for the guy who finished first would start in the 20th position. And Ryan Preece started on the pole, but unfortunately finished 25th. It's not a bad day for him, but it's just interesting to see that inverse. I really like that because it kind of gives us a little more of a, I guess the best way to put it is a little more perspective on how good some people's cars really can be.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And honestly, if you look down that top 10, I feel like there's a lot of drivers there that were glad that they were able to rebound it because, I mean, after Saturday, that was some hard point hits for a lot of teams. And we're getting down to crunch time now. This is not the time to start, you know, using up mulligans left and right. If you have any chance of making the playoffs, now is the time you got to get your season going because that was race number 15 in the regular season of 26. So we're down to it. We're almost to our final 10 races before the playoffs. And so this is where the wick's going to definitely be turned up if they're going to be trying to make a hope for a playoff bid.
For sure. And I think one big thing we do need to discuss about that is you have to be in the top 16 in points or have wins. So right now there's only 8 drivers with wins. Of them, only the top 4 have more than one win. And then from 8th to 5th, it is one win. And if you look at it, there's a one name on there you look at. You're just like, how is that even possible? Kyle Busch is outside the top 10 in points. He's still in the playoff position, but this is the first time in a very long time we've seen Kyle Busch outside the top 10 in points.
Which, you know, not quite yet ready to make the panic button there, but definitely maybe starting to be a little concerned there. He's right behind Kurt Busch. Definitely one of the higher drivers in points without a win, so that's definitely working in his favor, but not where we're accustomed to seeing that young driver. And there is a very, you know, it's not a high percentage, you know, we've never seen it happen before, but we could very well see 16 different winners in 2020, and that would, you know, lock out a guy like Kyle Busch who's hoping to make it in on points if they can't find their way to victory lane soon. So that'll be something else to keep an eye on. And also, you know, we're kind of looking down the finishing order there. He's finished 11th on Saturday, 12th on Sunday. This had to have been one of the better weekends for Matt Kenseth and that number 42 team. Since coming back to full-time racing, replacing Kyle Larson post-COVID break, he had that one solid top 10 finish at the second Darlington race, and it really looked like, hey, the 2003 champion really hasn't missed a beat. He's going to be doing all right. But then in the weeks since then, that organization has just tanked. That entire team has fallen off a cliff. He's struggled to get up to speed. The cars haven't been loading off the truck well. He's struggling getting a handle on that Camaro body because it's nothing like he was used to running a couple years ago for Gibbs in the Toyota camp. And it shows. He's right now ranked 30th in points, which he is technically eligible now for the playoffs, being in the top 30. All he would have to do is win a race. But when you look into comparison between him and Ryan Newman, who also came back about the same time, granted, Ryan Newman had one extra race to his credit than Matt Kenseth, but the difference between the two of them is Brian Newman's all the way found himself all the way up to 24th in points and has had a lot more consistency since returning back to competition than Kenseth has. And, you know, I knew the struggles would be there for the former champ. I knew it would be a tough learning curve not having practice to get that team chemistry working, to not be able to go visit the shop, to interact with the guys, and to really work on that dialogue between himself and his crew chief on what they're both looking for in a race setup. And it was encouraging to finally see him have not a flashy weekend, not a great weekend, but a solid weekend, which for an organization on the rebuild, just looking for any positive they can find in this 2020 season, that's the first step. That's what they need to start tackling now to really start hopefully getting that ship pointed in the right direction. But I don't know. It's still a bit of a head-scratcher over there in the Ganassi camp because I really think a lot of people had a lot higher expectations for that 42 car post this COVID break. And on the flip side of that, you know, it's not the equipment, because Kurt Busch is still doing quite well, sitting 10th in points, putting together solid, consistent finishes week in and week out. So a bit of a tougher learning curve, I think, for the whole entire Kenseth crew than what they were anticipating. But hopefully this is the much-needed shot in the arm that organization needed to get that ship pointed in the right direction and hopefully find them knocking on the door of more consistent top tens and maybe even a win for a possible chance at the championship.
Big thing we need to take away, though, with Matt Kenseth is the fact that he'd been out of a car for well over a year and a half. He had never worked with Chip Ganassi before, and he never really ran a Chevy, especially the newer advanced ones. He had ran one for a couple races in the 90s, but that's it. I would say the big thing for him, he's still trying to get used to this. And I feel a big thing for him is the lack of practice for these cars. If he would, I would say like this, if he would have had one practice session per race, he probably would be improving a lot more. But the fact that he's going into all these races blind, hasn't been in the car for well over a year, and especially as someone, you know, he is talented. We've seen him win races and stuff, but that's the big thing for him, is he's not getting as much practice as he would hope for. You know, he's not someone that'd be sitting in the simulator racing for, you know, 6-7 hours a week or something. He's someone that can really knows what a car can do once he gets it on the track. So I wouldn't write him off. If there's any time soon that we'll get a practice session, I would say then write him off if he doesn't perform well. But I would say we just need to keep an eye on that and definitely hope that we get back to somewhat racing regularly, so that way we can have a practice session, so that way we can see what people are all about. But you're right. I think one big thing we'll have to look for is to see where he can improve on coming up.
Exactly. Well, we're getting close to the wrap-up point here, so let's take you through our final race of the weekend. Denny Hamlin in the number 11 car did take his victory there, fourth of the season, sixth at the Pocono Raceway. Kevin Harvick followed him across the line in second, Eric Jones in third, Chase Elliott came home in fourth, Eric Almirola in fifth. An impressive run by Matt DiBenedetto and the Wood Brothers team, a solid sixth-place outing for the 21. William Byron in seventh, Clint Bowyer came across the line 8th, Alex Bowman in 9th, and Martin Truex Jr. rounded out the top 10. Brad Keselowski came home 11th, Matt Kenseth in 12th, Kurt Busch in 13th, Austin Dillon in 14th, and Ricky Stenhouse Jr. completed the top 15. Jimmy Johnson, making his final trip to the Tricky Triangle, came home a pretty disappointing 16th, all things considered, but fairly solid run for the Ally crew. Cole Custer in 17th, Ryan Newman in 18th, John Hunter Nemechek in 19th, and Bubba Wallace came home in 20th. 21st place went to Corey LaJoie, 22nd to Ryan Blaney, 23rd to Ty Dillon, 24th Joey Logano, 25th Ryan Preece, Daniel Suarez in 26th, Brennan Poole 27th, J.J. Yaley in 28th, Timmy Hill 29th, and James Davison in 30th. Quinn House came home in 31st, Garrett Smithley 32nd, Joey Gase in 33rd, Josh Balicki 34th, Tyler Reddick came home in 35th, Chris Buescher 36th, DJ McLeod came across the line 37th, Kyle Busch 38th, Christopher Bell 39th, and Michael McDowell came across the line in 40th.
Oof. Well, we look forward to this weekend. We only have about a couple moments. So the big thing we need to talk about this weekend is we are running at one of the most famous racetracks in the world, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, running two races, running the Brickyard 400 and running the Grand Prix course. And our good friend Greg Woods is going to love this. We're going to get our first practice sessions in for Xfinity, since they've never done this. That will be the only practice they'll have. They'll also have, if I'm not mistaken, they will be running the Indy cars and the Grand Prix track as well.
Correct. It's going to be a very exciting July 4th. So with coronavirus maybe affecting some of your more traditional 4th of July plans, why not pull up on the couch and enjoy some great action of racing? You've got the Xfinity race running first on that famous Grand Prix road course, like Zach said. And then IndyCar will join them in a very rare doubleheader weekend where we're featuring NASCAR stars and the IndyCar stars all in one weekend. And then, of course, the pinnacle racing around that famed 2.5-mile oval the Brickyard 400 on Sunday. Going to be a great race, and I can't wait.
I can't either. We got 30 seconds. I will say happy 4th of July. Make sure to party. Make sure to watch racing. Brady, what you got?
I just got to say, you know, for all you people out there, be smart this weekend. I know it's going to be hard not to do your normal 4th of July festivities, but use your best judgment. Try and keep each other safe. And I guess hashtag all countries matter.
And the
John,
real hashtag is come on down to Myrtle Beach and let's hang out and get a caricature down there on the boulevard. So look, thanks a lot. We'll see you guys next week on the Charlotte Line.
Where is she?